The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
I'm Matt Miller.
And I'm Hannah Elliott, and this is Hot Pursuit.
All right, Hannah, we have a lot of stories to talk about. You've been incredibly productive on the terminal. You've got a ton of stories there at Business Week at all the Bloomberg properties. But you also have a guest for us. I'm here with me in the New York studio. Who is it?
Yeah, this is Steve Serio, who I wrote about in 2020 in an article with the headline, "Looking for a Rare Classic Car? This is the Guy Billionaires Trust." And Steve is a very trusted source of mine that I've used for many years. And I think probably his most famous client is Jerry Seinfeld. So I just have to say, you know, this is somebody who I know has listened to our podcast, I think each one. And sometimes I can hear his voice in my head when we go down these rabbit trails talking about old Bentleys and Rolls Royces and Aston Martins. Steve, who owned the Aston Martin dealership in Boston for many years and now trades in Uber exclusive vehicles. I can hear his voice. He's correcting everything I say. So,
we'll
Steve,
give you
we're
a
really
chance,
happy
Steve,
to have
to correct
you.
Everything
yes,
he says.
We're very happy to have you in the studio.
I will say that Hannah told me you also used to sell spikers, and my neighbor heard about this, and he wants a spiker. So he said, "Hey, ask Steve about the spiker." So we're going to ask him about that as well. And the other
sell
cars,
Sell them is different than hold them.
And the other brands that you've worked with. We're also going to talk about a couple of the stories I mentioned. You have the terminal. A Cyber Beast is going on sale. What is this? Like a souped-up Cyber Truck?
Yeah, not to be confused with just the Cybertruck. The Cyber Beast has more horsepower. It's 845 horsepower. It's more expensive. It's about $100,000. This will be the first Cyber Beast offered at auction.
Okay. We'll get to that. Also, your McLaren 750S Spider review. I think a lot of people have been waiting for that one to hit the terminal for a while because this car is more highly anticipated than I expected. And
interesting.
I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about it. And then BMW's new concept for its electric SUV. We could go.
We're fans of BMW. If you have to have an EV,
yeah.
BMW's making.
I'm actually driving right now a BMW, the new 5 Series with an inline 4. And typically when I hear that, I don't want to drive the car anymore. 4 cylinders. For the first few days I had it in my driveway, I took my Challenger instead. But I'm really impressed with it. I don't really think you need much more in like an executive limousine. Anyway,
I can't believe you said that.
No, I know I can't believe
shocking.
I said it either. It's just a pretty, peppy little motor. Let's kick it off with the Cyber Beast. And Steve, I want to ask you, what's your take on the Cyber Truck? Everybody seems to have a love or hated opinion, but it's also like a whole thing.
Yeah, if an automobile could be the bubonic plague, it would be the Cybertruck, in my view. I'm not a fan. I know you guys have, or Hannah has driven it. I equate this to somebody who needs so much attention and they just don't want to light themselves on fire and run down the street. It is a screamingly awful
what do you really
thing
think
in my
of
view.
It?
Yeah, no, I just, it's why Musk must be so polarizing. Because I lived through him failing with the Roadster. When he was getting those cars from Lotus at the time, or the chassis, and Cybertruck is there's no, to me, I like things that are cutting edge. I like things that are new. I like things with fantastic technology in them. I've grown to appreciate more modern cars. I was always an old car guy, and I'm not anymore. But this needs to go over a cliff and just be buried in the desert. I hope all the wheels fall off at the first 100 miles.
Well, it does look...
No opinion, Hannah.
Hannah, I'm looking at your story, and the pictures of this Cyber Beast look like the stainless steel has somehow rusted already.
Stainless doesn't mean no rust. It just means less rust. So I have read some threads that people claim they're seeing some wear and tear on the truck already. But this one is interesting because we're actually already seeing resale prices of the Cybertruck dropping. Bring a Trailer just sold one earlier this week for $160,000, which was less than the $200,000 or so we were seeing for some auctions and Facebook sales previously. Obviously, the Cyber Beast is slightly different than the Cybertruck versions, but it's the same truck.
What, just so because it has more horsepower? That's the only difference, right?
Yeah, visually it looks the same, except for it has a little badge on the side that says, or it looks like a dog.
So but the suspension is the same, the interior is the same.
Pretty much,
it doesn't have,
yeah,
like a better stereo.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Range is a little bit less.
I feel
actually,
like DeLoreans have aged better than this, and it's only been out for like half a year.
Agreed. I mean, I think is this what Pete Buttigieg imagines us all driving since he's now jumped on the, if you have to have an internal combustion car after 2032, you're effectively a good American. So, Pete, we'll all be driving these.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Our automotive analyst, Kevin Tynan, that we have here at Bloomberg Intelligence, I was just on the phone with him yesterday, and he has covered OEMs, especially the big three in Detroit, and trucks for so long. And he has a really interesting perspective, you know, on Cybertruck, and basically said sales like this are just a result of scarcity more than actual demand. You know, there's one for sale, so someone's going to want to buy it.
I thought it was really cool at first, 4 years ago when they showed the prototype, just because it was different and edgy, but it now looks not good.
Can I tell you, I see them in Beverly Hills all the time. They're like, this is not a rare thing anymore. It's really interesting. I mean, they're, at least in LA, they're kind of ubiquitous.
Steve, what do you think about EVs in general? Because Hannah and I think we agree that there are a lot of good products already out there. Maybe they're expensive, but the BMW iX is one that I think we both like. I love the Kia EV9. Hannah was just in an EV supercar with Super Blondie, right? The Hyperion. What do you think about EVs in general?
Well, I don't want to say that I'm out of my element. I'm such a non-fan that I don't follow a lot of them because I really think, when you travel through Europe as much as I do, you hear about how EVs don't work. And they only work in the United States, in my small, humble opinion, on the coasts. So you've got people who, EVs make a lot of sense for a lot of people who are driving in urban environments and have short commutes every day, and it's easy for them to plug them in. I don't see them. I will go out on a limb and say, I think it's a hiccup in automotive history. I think there'll be a better way to do this. I think hybrid is a better way to do it. I think there's too much of the country that fails at setting up networks to charge these cars. And I, again, reading Biden's, we're going to put up 500,000 EV, stations, and he's done, I think the count last week was 7 or 12 under the government watch. So I'm too much of a car guy not to find 95% of them utterly soulless. And having just had a Taycan in the shop to sell on one of our Bring a Trailer auctions, I drove it around the block and thought, why would anybody want one of these? And it was a perfectly adequate, fine, quick car, but it's soulless and it's like driving an iPad. And that's not where I've come from in the last 35, almost 40 years of doing this. It's
some people want to drive iPads.
Yeah.
Just not you and me.
Yeah, no. I there's lots of folks who really have an utter disdain for anything that they have to get in and drive because they hate driving, and this makes it easy for them. And if you can go home and, plug it in and not put gas in your car. The false narrative to me has always been the people that feel better about the environment when they're driving one. And we could sit here and talk for the next 5 hours of why it isn't. Because I guess, as we say in Massachusetts, sort of white women from Wellesley feel good about driving these things because they don't care about all the people dying in Africa mining the lithium. Because if you go down that path with them, you get shut down.
Yes.
Or is that too edgy a comment?
No, let's not even go there. I've dated a few women from Wellesley, though.
So did I.
Wow.
I totally get what you're saying, and I feel pretty much the same way. On the other hand, being kind of a new father, I need a little bit more utility out of vehicles than I have in the past. So when I test drove the BMW iX, I was really impressed at what a great family hauler it was. When I test drove the EV9, the Kia EV9, I was blown away because it's a Kia and it's like such great quality. And like, you know, it's not for going up to Bear Mountain and ripping up around the corners. It's great though for like rear facing car seats and taking the kids to an Easter egg hunt. So I think there's a place. And speaking of that, BMW has just come out with a new concept. Hannah, you wrote about it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is another one of their Neue Klasse concepts that they're sort of unveiling to show where the company is going in the future. It's an SUV. It will go up against Mercedes electric SUVs. And the thing that I really actually like about it is that the kidney grille is now small again. We're seeing like quite a lot of fluctuation with this grille. It's a little bit of a schizophrenic BMW. They're not quite sure what they're doing, but I actually like the small one. They're saying by the end of 2025, we'll see the production of this. So it's just another basically notch in the cog that BMW is moving forward with their EV program. You know, it's interesting. They were toying around with hydrogen for a moment, too. We haven't heard much about the hydrogen program, but they're definitely going forward with the
electric. I remember them doing that back in 2000.
Yeah. Yeah, they were some of the first.
I feel like BMW is doing just a better job at building EVs. Now, nothing to do with the concept. Now, right? Mm-hmm. The i4, the i5, the iX, than everyone else in that. They aren't striving to make them something better or different or weird.
This is very interesting to me because remember the i8 and how advanced that was? And they kind of beat everyone in terms of making a very cool, well-driving hybrid.
And yeah, it had a range extender.
Yeah, and I actually thought that was a really great car. And then it just felt like they kind of plateaued for a while and everyone else caught up. But I do think BMW has it in them to make really interesting, compelling, fun-driving machines, and maybe they're hybrids. Matt, I know you love a hybrid.
So does Steve.
So yeah. So it will be interesting to see where they go from here because I think they've got the potential to really capitalize and shoot forward in a way that they haven't been at the forefront.
What's your take on BMW?
I've always liked BMWs. The last new BMW I owned was a 1988 M5. So I came close to buying an X5, again, when kids, you know, twins came into our life 16 years ago, 16 and a half years ago, went in a different direction, was always a Land Rover person at that time. I think the company out of Germany that can be the most innovative for consumer automobiles. Again, I wonder in this hedge, with BMW going towards EV, with Volvo going all EV, right? And then you've got Lotus going all EV. What happens if this thing does a 180? And people just go, I'm not going to be forced to buy one of these. I'm not. It's still, as oil is coming out of the ground, as all this fossil fuel is still available, I'm comfortable with an internal combustion engine. And the masses don't get swayed. I mean, I know in Germany, having been there, there is a backlash against some of the green effort there now because there's a lot of right-wing policies coming into German politics, and some of it is now sort of pushing down some of the green advances that Germany has made over the years. But I don't know. It's a great company. Again,
I'm backlash, I think, everywhere, right?
I'm very curious to hear you say that BMW is the most innovative company coming out of Germany, or could be, because you deal so much in Porsche as well. It's a surprising statement.
Well, I think looking at as them as car companies, BMW is such a broader company that appeals to so many people economically. And I think they also cross over more into genders. I know there are women who buy Porsches. I know there are a lot of women who buy BMWs. I mean, it is a numbers game, but I think there's more. I always get a kick out of the fact that BMW dealers can't carry all of their cars because there's too many variants and too many derivatives of their cars. So
it's very confusing.
Yeah, if you went to their website and said, oh, I want to buy the fill in the blank, and you go to the dealer and it's like, yeah, well, we'd have to order you one because we haven't had one in 3 months, and we might get one next month of what you're looking for. I think that's where BMW gets confusing, and it kind of falls on its face a little bit as a manufacturer.
Yeah.
But I think they're very innovative. I mean, you lost me after Chris Bangle. I mean,
yeah, Chris Bangle kind of threw me for a curve as well.
Yeah.
So
bring back the Bangle butt.
But I love the, you know, the styling is still controversial. Hannah mentioned the grills,
the
right?
Grill.
I like the big grills.
I don't mind them. They're
I know
fine.
A lot of people don't, though. Yeah. I love the new M2. You know? And a lot of people don't like that. I've lust after that thing. And I have a friend who's a big collector in Bedford. I'm sure you know him. I won't say his name, but. The new M2 is the first new car that he's bought in like 20 years.
That's interesting.
So they, you know, they make progress in places that you may not expect.
One thing I noticed on this concept, speaking of sort of the design element, is, you know, the Hofmeister kink, the element.
Back to the 3.0
right,
BMW.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, you know, people who go really nuts for this type of thing notice and love, they've sort of done away with that and added like a reflective strip instead of a chrome detail on this concept, which is another thing that shows I sense they're experimenting. It seems like they're trying to find their footing a little bit, and maybe they've put that out to test the waters a bit.
It's sometimes cool when car makers break with tradition. That's a big deal. Like, well, it's not a car maker, but when Ducati started making the V4s and everybody knew them for their twins, for the purists, it was like sacrilege.
Well, it's what saved BMW when they were building. They were going in the wrong direction in the 50s with the 501, 503, 507. And as they were approaching the precipice of, you know, massive failure, they finally realized, well, we've got the Isetta. Which was innovative. We've got the small 700 series cars, and then they broke into what saved them, which was a 1600 going into the 2002. So they've always been innovative to save their own skin. I mean, maybe that's looking back and kind of coloring it the way I want to for the argument, but I think they've always done that. I mean, they have threatened to fail many times. And the 2002 is absolutely still one of my favorite classic cars. I mean, having owned, Hannah, do you know, this is embarrassing. I've had 13 of them.
Wow.
I had no idea.
So,
wow.
Yeah,
I'm shocked.
I've owned every derivative of that car except the turbo, which I never liked the look of. But
I've never heard you talk about those ever.
Yeah. And Amanda would my wife, Amanda, to the audience, would look at me and go, "That's not the same colored one that was in the garage a year ago. Did you get another one?" It was like, "Yeah, I got another one. I got rid of the last one. Is this the last one?" "Yes, this is going to be the last one." And then inevitably, there was never a last one until about 4 years ago. And then I finally just said, I've wrung this out as far as I can take it with the Alpina 2000 TII Touring, which was a magnificently driving car, but it was just this weird little thing. You know, I just always had a fondness for them.
Steve, this brings up a question that I've never asked you. And maybe Matt, you have a take on this too. What is the agreement with the significant other about buying new vehicles? Do you have to ask for permission or run it by her, or do you kind of just switch them out in the garage and maybe she notices at a later date?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cheat for me having been in the business.
Well, it is the business.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
sure.
There are a great many things that would come and go that I had no intention of keeping. So I think there's always that, have I been in this before?
She's saying that.
Yeah.
She's wondering,
Or where did this come from? And I have a mental log of dollars that I will tie up in cars. And if I'm buying something, I've got to get rid of something. So Amanda has given me massive latitude over the years to go, this is interesting. I like this. I don't like this. The car that she likes the most, I think you'll appreciate, Hannah, is the Bentley GT. So few cars she's ever gotten in and says, I really like this car.
Yeah.
So
it's a car for adults.
A Continental GT.
Yeah. The W12, the big nine on the grill for the Le Mans version.
Nice.
It's completely obnoxious and wonderful.
I love the number on grill. It's so nice that they do that.
It's so interesting, too, just to see your sort of embrace of modern cars, too, because as someone who really deals with classics, Steve, you you do also buy modern cars. It's not one or the other for you. It seems that you really enjoy both.
It was a slow burn. And I think the car that did it for me, Amanda has a 50th anniversary 911 that we got new. And it's her car. And I didn't really even, I hadn't spent much time in modern 911s that I wanted to ever keep or thought about ordering. And that car bit me. And I always refer to it as a sweet spot car. They just, Porsche nailed it with the exterior, the amount of performance, the PDK box in it.
The interior, too. You could get the woven seats. Cloth seats. Yeah.
Yep. So that led me down the rabbit hole. I mean, again, Matt, we were talking earlier about what I've sold. New Aston Martin. I was a Lotus dealer first, then Aston Martin, then Bugatti, then Celine, then Spyker, Vespa. I think that's it.
Cool,
I can't remember.
Vespa.
So yeah, everybody tried something for a while. And none of those things, I never fit well in the modern Astons until the shooting brake that I ended up keeping. I've got a Vanquish shooting brake at home.
Nice.
So that's a comfortable car for me. That generation Vanquish from sort of 2009 DBS forward, I thought, yeah, I could keep one of these cars.
I've never seen a Vanquish shooting brake in real life.
Well, there's only 14 of them in North America, 11 in the United States, 3 in Canada. And I had no intention of keeping it. It was a fire sale in the sense that Aston Martin had to get it off their books on New Year's Eve 2019. They wanted it gone out of their inventory. And I got a call East Coast time, I think at about 9 o'clock, and they were still working in California, and said, do you have anybody that would want this car? Would you take it in inventory? And we negotiated a price on it. And it came in. It was the last one in the United States that they had to do something with. And it showed up. And I thought, this is unbelievable.
What color?
Black. It's all black.
They're gorgeous.
So, yeah, it's an utterly, in many ways, an utterly useless car because it's two doors. The back area is, sort of this hollow space. You can't really put anything behind you because it'll come flying forward when you stop, you know, so there's no divider, really, except a bar. And out of all the automobiles I've ever had, that is the best sounding car because with all the carbon fiber in it, the exhaust resonates through the car like nobody's business. And every time I'm in it, if I'm talking to a colleague or a friend, they'll say, you're in the Aston Martin, aren't you? Because if you step on it, it just goes right through the phone. So that's cool.
Did you sell it or do you have it?
No, I have it.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And I threaten.
Keep.
Well, Hannah, this goes back to conversation earlier. You can't keep everything. So this one may be on the bubble.
How does it work at your house, Hannah? Because you are a buyer of classic cars, and your partner, Magnus Walker, obviously is a collector of classic cars. Do you have to tell each other when you're going to buy one, or are you always with each other? How's that work?
That's a really good question. There certainly has never been a discussion about you need to tell me before you do anything. Obviously, he has his own money. He does what he wants. I have my own money. I do what I want. But the thing is, it just naturally comes up in conversation. We're together all the time. We're constantly looking at cars. We're constantly sending each other links on Bring a Trailer. If it involves a Rolls Royce, we're sending it to Steve Serio too, who invariably tells us, do not buy that. He's kind of like, I can kind of tell if he's interested in something. I certainly would never get upset with him if he doesn't have to ask my permission, you know. And I don't think he would get upset with me for bringing home anything. Now, I'm kind of wanting to bring home a puppy. We'll see how that goes over. But no, it's very free-flowing.
What about new cars? Like, does either one of you have any interest in buying a new car or a modern car that's not a 911?
The cars I like that are modern, I cannot afford. So that's it. I have expensive taste for modern cars, and I'm very spoiled. So yeah. I think that's another reason why I only buy old things for my own self. I want something that is really interesting to me and fun to drive and has a personality. And typically those kinds of cars, if they're modern, tend to be expensive. So those are out of my price range.
And that's why I started buying motorcycles. And I've never had the issue of buying a car without telling my wife, but I have showed up with new Ducatis, and she made a rule a while back: if you buy another motorcycle without telling me, I'm going to get a cat. And then all of a sudden, we had two cats, and I realized,
yes,
don't make that mistake again.
See, I kind of was thinking that the last Corvette we bought, obviously, he bought it because he liked the one that I drive so much. And I thought, well, if he's going to get another Corvette, maybe I'll get another dog, you know?
Would you have a McLaren 750S Spider,
no,
Hannah?
No, that's a great question, Matt Miller. And no, I would not, because the McLaren is a ode to robotic clinical precision. And I'm actually not somebody who wants or needs clinical precision in my life. I know there are great swaths of people who really love McLaren for that reason. And I would say the 750S is a very fun and fast car to drive, but it is really clinical. The interior is minimal. Of course, the center console screen is still really frustrating to use, and that's sort of been a thing with McLaren. It's really narrow and vertical, and there are lots of layers you have to go through to, you know, do simple tasks like get to the navigation or the audio. But, you know, in terms of a car that
is weird looking. I'm looking at your story on Bloomberg.com, and
yes.
I did not expect that.
It's like, if you want to get a car that really screams, I've got a supercar, it's perfect, because it will let everybody know you are in a expensive supercar. And if that's what you want.
No, but I mean the screen. I love the look of the car,
oh,
and
the
I
screen.
Love the color. Hannah okay. and I have had this discussion before. It's like a slate blue. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, but you know what? It kind of looked almost periwinkle in real life, and I was kind of cringing at it. But then in photographs, as I was looking back at photographs, I thought it kind of looks amazing, especially against the red rocks out
there. But the screen is
it.
So weird.
The
I like that it's
is
small.
Really weird. Yeah, I don't. It's just so odd. This has been a thing with McLaren, and I have to say the interior of the car really has improved in terms of fit and finish and quality. That has really been an issue with McLaren, and they really have worked hard to improve that, so no dings for that at all. I would say, obviously, if you're a bigger guy or someone who's not incredibly flexible or agile, you might look a little awkward getting in and out of this car because it's so low, and the doors open in... They open up, of course. They have that dihedral opening system. And I saw a lot of guys looking a little awkward getting in and out, to be honest.
Steve, what do you think about McLaren? About the brand?
The architecture has never resonated with me. I know too much about the manufacturing to care. I've had this conversation with Hannah before about, you know, who fails first, Aston Martin or McLaren. I think we've had that discussion.
This is an ongoing discussion, yes.
But I appreciated the F1 and have sold a couple of them over the years. I understand why that was the ultimate car for a generation of people and why they command the dollars they command and, you know, successful racing program. But nothing... It does nothing for me. And going back to the crossover from old cars to new cars, I think that's why I have really been a just lover of modern Porsches, the 911, because in a great many ways, it's still the old car. It's not filled. I mean, we used to say this about Aston Martins. If you want a lot of tech, go buy a Mercedes-Benz, go buy a BMW. Aston was always very low tech. And purposely done up until a point where they couldn't afford new tech, but the ethos of the company was the driving experience. And when they were making manual transmission cars, you didn't buy one because it had, you know, you bought a Lexus if you wanted all the widgets in the early 2000s.
A video game.
Yeah. And yeah. Getting in my wife's 912, getting in the 50th anniversary car, or getting in, you know, I've got a GTS Targa, and I've also got the pair of sport classics, the old one and the new one, they all, you fit in it and you kind of go, ah, this is why I love this, because of simplicity. It's just, it's home. And I love right. the simplicity of it. Every time I look at a new car, and the hypercars really have zero appeal to me. I mean, for A, they're expensive. B, you can't use them.
All of them? Know, even the Chiron?
Doesn't do anything for me. Now, I appreciate it, but when that came out in its first form in the Veyron, Nah, I mean, I don't have the life
either,
where I would
either,
use
but
it.
But this Chiron, I think, is just beautiful.
It's beautiful.
I can't wait
to
see the successor coming out in June.
Yeah, okay, beautiful to look at. And the Hannah, to your point, even if I could afford them, I can nowhere near afford them, I wouldn't have one because I don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And if I can't do something with it, it's that well overused phrase, I'd rather drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow.
For sure. That's what I love about this BMW I'm driving right now. It's got this i4, but the engine is responsive, and it's fun to move the pedal around and play with the acceleration.
You're engaged.
Yeah.
You're engaged.
And it's only, I think, 250 horsepower or something, but it's perfect. Wow. I would like the car to be smaller. Now I want to try that in like a 3 or a 2.
Yeah, the horsepower wars always make me giggle because it's like, okay. Do you have your own private highway? Where are you going with 1,000 horsepower, 1,200 horsepower, 600,
But it's not going, right? Hannah, you drive and test out these hypercars all the time, mm-hmm. and you were just mm-hmm. talking to Supercar Blondie, who also does it as well. I imagine the people who buy them the same way they would buy like a Rothko, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing I've noticed, and obviously Steve can talk about this too, but especially with the decommissioned formula cars, I'm really fascinated by the people buying those, because obviously you can't drive them and they are being purchased like pieces of art. And I wanted to ask Steve too, I'm very curious about, we're talking about hypercars. What about electric hypercars like the Nevera from Rimac or the Pininfarina Battista? People, I think, to your point, Matt, are purchasing those because they think they're significant and historically important, but I don't get the sense that they're buying them to drive them. Is that what you're seeing, Steve, as well?
Yeah, I don't. The folks that I know that have put deposits on a great many of those things that you wonder if they're ever going to get delivered, it almost seems like a worldwide vanity project with the manufacturers, those small car mm-hmm. guys. I applaud Koenigsegg for going down the road they did and became a real company.
Yes.
Pagani became a real company. Neither of which appealed to me on any level. But the electric cars.
You ever go to the factory?
I've never been to the factory. I've had a few of them in trade. And I
highly recommend a tour of the factory if you're ever in the Motor Valley.
I would like to do that. I would like to see how those things come together.
That sounds a little shady.
Well, I know the engines come from Mercedes-Benz.
But. Yeah.
I don't get it. Like the Batista is the classic thing. I mean, it came out with all this fanfare. When are you going to see it? I mean, we laugh about this, Hannah, when we talk about things like the Radford or these little vanity mm-hmm. project companies. Mm-hmm. When you have to pencil it out and it doesn't pencil out, that's when I lose interest in it. If it's not mm-hmm. a real thing, Singer became a real thing.
I was just going to ask you, when did Singer cross over for you?
Private equity.
Okay.
When they morphed into one big space and they got mm-hmm. big money behind them and they came out with their DLS and that's become a real car company. I'd still love to look at the numbers just for my own curiosity. I mean, I've got no stake in it, and the private equity guys are, that team of people are widely successful, and I don't think they bought it as a pet project. They want to make money with it.
I just had dinner with one of the principals.
Wagner?
Of Knighthead.
Interesting.
They do a number of other things also besides cars. Hannah and I have been talking about it. They own some WEC racing teams. They own the British Football Club.
Well, I mean, the guys in this city, when they bought Hertz, that was a big turnaround for them. And they sponsor my pal's Jota, Team Jota, that runs at Le Mans.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's my dear friend is the principal of that team. So I get it. So I think Singer properly jumped into a real car company. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm.
Is Gunther Works there?
No. Nowhere near. I know just enough about that to be dangerous. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a real company behind them. Mm-hmm. We'll see how they survive the whoopsie at
the
Laguna.
The latest incident, yeah.
I just watched the Theon design video on Harry's Garage. Have you seen that? It's
no.
like the
what
British Singer.
I don't know what that is.
It's
never
like the British Singer, and they haven't made too many, but it looks amazing. And Harry Metcalf made the same comment that, I've heard Hannah make before about, like, I don't really want to get into these kind of these kind of resto mod car companies, because you never know what you're getting, and it could be just kind of a big scam. But he said this car is legit. And that's a guy whose opinion I trust.
Well, Tuthill makes a great 911, you know, sort of version. You know, they make great stuff.
Right.
They don't make it. They're not making any money doing it.
Right.
I mean, it's just kind of an arm of their business for marketing, I think. I know he'd like to make more of them, but I don't think that's something that is cost effective. The volume isn't there.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
Why don't we get on to the main event?
Yes.
Which is, yes. I don't know exactly what you took from our brief, because Hannah and Steve and I are on a text,
on a group text
message chain. I was like, hey, what are the five cars you would take to a desert island if there was a racetrack but no mechanic? And then Hannah was like, no, that's not a good idea. Let's do something else. So what did we
actually...
like,
I want a mechanic, no racetrack.
Yes. I mean, my idea was that, you know, cars that... The reason I thought of it was because we're always talking about she has these Rolls Royces and I really want a Bentley Turbo R or maybe an Arnage.
Yes. Yeah. I need to say a pinpoint here. This is what really got me to get Steve on the podcast, because we had this long discussion about possibly Matt getting into some Bentleys, and the whole time I was like, we need Steve Serio to set us straight.
I was listening to you on the treadmill that day, and my head was, I was doing an exorcism. My head was spinning.
Well,
because of you,
my concern is, my concern is that you buy a Bentley for, I don't know, you can get them for 20, you can get them for 60, right? But around that space, and then you end up putting double or triple the amount of them in repairs.
Well, exactly, because the cars you're buying for 20 or 60 have depreciated to that point, because they were never very good cars to begin with. They were woefully expensive to fix from new. And now that they're 10, 15, 20, 30 years old, they're orphans. And again, not all of them, but it's a period where, and I talk about this when I get calls from people and they say, I want to buy a Lagonda. I went through this list with Hannah. There are like the four horsemen of the apocalypse in the car world: the Lagonda, the Aston Martin Virage, and Bentley fill in the blank, probably early gen Turbo R, and a Maserati Quattroporte. They're all,
avoid those, is what you're saying.
There's a period of time when all that manufacturing was so awful, and the technology, whether it was a wiring harness, whether it was a water pump, whether it was the weight of the car against the systems that were in it, they were all
the transmission shifting actuator.
They were all all under engineered, and now they're old things. And this is an adage from an old mechanic of mine. A lot of these cars haven't been used over the years, which means you're still aging when you sleep, right? So these cars are all aging as they sleep. And if people aren't using them, every system is falling apart in the car while it's sitting there. And they were so overly complex at the time, because Bentley was still independent, Rolls was still independent, Aston Martin was still independent, Maserati was kind of not really getting looked at by Ferrari yet. And it's like the engineers went, okay, I'm going to draw this beautiful shape. Oh, now we have to make it go, and we have to make it stop, and we have to have things in it like windows that go up and down. And you take any of those cars and you go, oh, absolutely not. And I how old are you?
I'm 50.
Okay, and see, I would have said you were 40. So
well,
there you go.
I appreciate that.
So
he's very youthful.
I think the people who are now getting interested in these era cars that were just, I know this is a PG show, so I can't use the language I want to use,
but they were like the most expensive cars in the world at the time.
Yeah. Okay, the people that owned them originally suffered for all of us.
Right.
You know, they're all up on a cross somewhere. And now a whole generation of people are interested in these cars that had no idea what they were like when they were new. So they see these things and go, ooh, I could own a Rolls Royce or a Bentley or an Aston Martin. And I get the calls because I used to, you know, my history in the Aston world of, well, how bad can it be? And it's like, you can't imagine how bad it could be because it was so bad when the cars were new, we were dumbfounded.
But I look at Hannah, you know, she bought a Rolls Royce from the 70s. I think Magnus bought one from the
60s. Yeah, he got one when he saw how much I liked mine.
And those two drive their Rolls Royces all the time, and they never break down.
And Steve definitely told us, don't do that.
Well, no, that's when I learned Magnus does not want anybody's opinion. That's when I stopped.
It's very true.
That's when I stopped giving him my opinion about anything. Well, again, yeah, now you're older. See, now you're into older tech from
the older
60s.
Generation.
Yeah, 50s, 60s, and 70s. There's only
analog.
So many things that could go wrong.
So they made the smart move, and they didn't buy like the Arnage or the Continental T or whatever.
I will tell you what, Hannah, you know my shadow story.
I was going to say, you always said there was one car that broke you.
Oh, that was Turbo R. That was my Bentley Turbo R. At the time the Sopranos was on, the car was black. It was very northern New Jersey.
Yeah, I love the way it looks so much.
And it's the only car, every time I brought it in for service, because my shop couldn't work on it, it was between $4,000 and $6,000. And I bought one with 30,000 miles on it. I loved driving it. I think I had it for 2.5, maybe 3 years, and I easily doubled the money. Well, the original price, I think, was about $30,000, $32,000. I put another $35,000 in it and probably sold it for $25,000. That was my own personal lesson.
So sad.
And I know you talked about Matt Farah, and I know Matt, and I've talked to him about buying that car. He bought
a Turbo R also.
He bought a unicorn that was a one-owner car with 20,000 miles on it that had always been serviced. If he starts driving
But sitting. But sitting, Steve.
Yeah. Well, he's now started to... Now he's going to use
it.
And I hope it doesn't give him the fits and starts it gave me. But my better Rolls story is I did a transaction in Switzerland a couple of years ago, and there was a 1980 Shadow 2 in the deal. And it was a 13,000-mile car, and it had been sitting for about 3 years. And in the transaction, it was multiple Porsche transaction and a couple of other cars, we valued the Rolls at zero. We put like no money on the car and said, okay, well, whatever we can sell this for will be profit.
Yeah.
So there was a road rally. Cam Ingram and I were doing it. Cam put together with a bunch of aluminum Porsches, some 550s and Abarths. And going
Cam owns Road Scholars.
Road Scholars in
North
Durham.
North Carolina.
And we were going from Villa d'Este to St. Moritz to the Porsche factory through the Black Forest. And I thought, what a great chase car this would be to take on the rally, because everybody's driving a 550 or an RSK or an Abarth. We thought this would be, if there's inclement weather.
It has a roof.
It has a roof. Yeah, people can get in it. And
you can stretch out.
So I gave it to one of the premier shops in London and said, go through the car. And I said, I need the car to be brand new. I need it to start. I need every single system in the car to work properly. Now, again, I started with a 13,000-mile car that had been sitting for a couple of years. It was a one-owner car. $48,000 later, it was ready and ready to go on the road trip, and it performed like it did in 1980. It was perfect. But for $48,000, none of it was internal to the engine. None of it was internal to the transmission. It was brakes, suspension, air conditioning,
electrical,
couple of window motors, just stuff. And when we were done with it, I had a great experience with it, and I thought, I'll never use this car like I just used it, so we're going to find another home for it. And for $48,001, it now lives in New Jersey with a guy who loves it.
Didn't you have people on that rally joining you in the Rolls Royce because it was rainy and cold and everyone wanted to ride in
Mr. Ingram came in. Jeff Swart's wife came in.
There you go.
Matt Katz came in and took a nap. I mean, and if somebody got in the back seat, you haven't experienced on your motorcycle. Imagine this, going up and down One of the passes going into San Moritz from Italy. The switchbacks, I think, are 113.
I know them well.
And try doing that at speed in a Rolls-Royce Shadow. I mean, the guys behind me were always videotaping the car, listing from side to side to side, and you'd scrape the inner fender with the tires.
I'm shocked you could make that turn with that with that wheelbase.
Oh, yes.
Around some of those switchbacks. I'm surprised you didn't have to do a couple, like a 3-point turn around every switchback.
It was an experience, but that, you know, I loved the car. I had, if the car was, you know, I've had an extra space in the garage, would I have it? I'd have that car, but you know, it doesn't fit in my life. I have a 500E that's a proper four-door.
So that's what I'm talking about. And that's the kind of car that, I mean, you'll have issues like any other car and you've got to service it, but it's not going to break.
No.
That's a bulletproof motor. What are the five cars that you've brought? Let's get to the list.
Get to Serio's list.
So the list of things on an island that you could use and park and they would start the next day without any aggravation, you go right to the top of the food chain in a 300SL, a Gullwing. So Gullwing or Roadster, depending on your preference. I've always preferred the Gullwing. I owned one for 3 years, 4 years. I think that is such an engineering marvel. You cannot fault that car if you're starting with the baseline of a good one.
Beautiful car, obviously.
Yeah, and I did the Mille Mille in that car.
Yes.
And thrashed it. I was with a Magnus who thrashed it and did not miss a beat. Never broke down, never left us out.
The Gullwing or the Roadster?
Gullwing.
And you prefer that one too, Hannah?
Yeah. Yeah,
I do
have
too.
Fair skin.
Just because of the doors.
I don't do well in the sun.
You don't. then you go to the other extreme.
And by the way, that's $1 million car now, right?
Oh, it's more
three.
Than that. Depending on the car. The interesting thing about the Gullwing is it was the first car made in volume over 1,000 units that consistently brought $1 million. I forget when this was. It was years ago now. But that was the car that was the benchmark of, oh, these are all $1 million now. And they made a lot of them, made 1,400 of them.
Mm. Can we say that was the first supercar?
I consider it to be the first supercar. A lot of people think the Miura was the first supercar, but that's a sports car. That's a sports car versus a GT car thing. I think the Gullwing had better, well, it has racing provenance where the Miura has none.
Yeah.
I would call that the first wow car. And if I could have one car back, so long ago, Matt, I'll put the measure on it that it was $272,500 when I bought my car.
When I bought it.
Yeah. So that was back in the day, and I loved it. So the other extreme, not to be sound like, you know, sort of like, oh, I'm only going to pick expensive cars, you get a Volvo P1800. And a car that,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
A car that you can
good
do
one.
3 million miles
sure.
in. Like the
famously.
Guy from, yeah, so that is, I had a 64 P1800 for a handful of years. Loved it. Loved looking at it. That's a car you'd look at as
They've made a huge comeback, frankly.
Oh, yeah they have. Yeah. So that would be car number two. Three, you go back into the...
What's the motor in the Gullwing? Is that a inline six?
Yes.
And then I wonder what is in the P1800.
It's a four.
That school teacher, Irv
Gordon.
Irv Gordon, yes, yeah. Who drove his... Millions of like
three million miles.
There you go.
Yeah,
you
and
go.
You're right. It's an inline four, 1800.
And that was a 66 or so.
60. His was a straight bumpered car. I think it wasn't the horn bumpered car, so it had to be 66, 67.
Okay.
But I had an early one with the horn bumpers, and it was black with a red interior. Again, I like trying different things. I didn't. That's a Jensen. That's a very early one. So that's.
I'm just clicking through.
That's really cool. So that would be a thing you could drive, and you park it, and it starts, and everything works.
Any problems, you got a toolbox, you're good, right?
You got a pliers and a spark plug wrench and a couple of fuses.
Yeah.
Performance-wise, you go back into the 60s, and one of my favorite cars is a 289 Cobra. And again, you're getting that iconic Cobra. It's simple. If you've got spark and you've got fuel, your fuel pump's working, and that's nothing there. There's nothing to the car, and any Cobra that has been set up, you can bleed
now for an original. Again, we're talking about a million dollar car, right?
Yeah.
Even the replicas, even the like kit cars, I see going on BAT for like. You know, $100,000.
Or you can spend $250 on a copy, which is mind numbing to me. But yeah, mm-hmm. I I'd go there, and I'd also say the sister to that is the GT350 Mustang, the Shelby Mustang.
Ooh.
Because, you know, again, a car that I've had, and it never failed to start. It just never, ever, ever failed to start. Always proceeded forward. You know, it just always a great thing. So I put the 289, anything with a 289 engine.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't that the same motor?
It's the
5 liter, yeah.
So, and then I'd go to the car I previously mentioned.
So far we have, let's keep track. We've got the Gullwing. That's a $3 million car.
Volvo.
The Volvo P1800, you could probably pick one up for 20 or 30 grand.
Yeah, right? But you really want a great one. So now those are 50, 60.
Okay.
Okay, so, that's the budget option.
The Cobra, if you want an original, it's going to be
A million plus. Yeah.
But are you good with like a nice replica?
I've owned replica things, so I can't cast any shade on a replica.
Somebody must make a really good one, right?
Oh, yeah. A handful of people do.
Yeah.
So that's...
All right, so we've got the 350 is the sister. So we've got...
That's four.
Those... Well, let's say the three, because the sisters...
Well, yeah, the sisters,
right.
Yeah.
All right.
Then I'm going back to the car I talked about previously, which was a 2002 BMW. Again, so not everything has to be expensive. You know, proper fuel injected... 72 or 73 TII in a great color sunroof. I mean, I've driven one across the country. They are, again, park it. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to have any issues with it. You know,
and you could easily fix. I have a friend who fixed his own in high school. You know, didn't need to bring it
to
a
mechanic.
That's cool. Yeah,
cool.
When you can go across the country and all you need to be safe, you always bring sort of. Hoses. You bring a brake. You bring a flexible brake line. You bring all your engine hoses. You know, so something could clamp could go or something. So anything that can be fixed like that, and you're comfortable going across the country, that's to me is perfect. And then Hannah, I'm gonna be surprised if you couldn't guess my fifth car.
G-Wagon.
Well, that's modern, so
they're made since 79. Yeah. I mean, that's classic to me.
Yeah,
get a classic one up.
Let's be clear. Let's be clear because they have been made since 1979, but I think you
classic.
And I are on the same page. I will only drive the new, like 2019 and newer.
Newer, right.
I don't want to drive the older ones.
I'll take an old Pook.
Speedster. Porsche Speedster.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, I guess the flat six is easy to work on. And
four. The box of four. The old car. The 1957, 58 Speedster.
Yes. Okay, I thought you were talking about like a newer one.
Oh, no. So, again, I've had a Speedster since 1997.
Yes.
I've driven them across the country. And if you can do 600 miles a day in a Speedster comfortably...
You are brave in that car seat.
So, yeah, that's I'm more brave in L.A. than I probably want to be driving it around.
It's great, though.
But I've got a Speedster that's done 11 rallies, 1,000-mile rallies. It's got a cheater hot rod engine in it made by John Wilhoit. Instead of making 60 horsepower, it makes 164. So it's got disc brakes now. But I've got
and
two of them.
And you drive it everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great.
Yeah, so that would be, if I had to have one car, it would be a toss-up between the Gullwing and the Speedster. Because the Speedster, in many ways, is more usable and it's just easier to drive everywhere. But those would be the five cars. So old cars, that would be the sort of...
What are Speedster prices like these days? For running driving, not a Concours level, but
You can spend $300,000 and get a perfectly fine car that you have is a good 5-footer. You know, don't look at the gaps. It might not have the original engine. Could be a color change.
I like that. Just kind of squint.
Yeah, squint a little bit.
Yeah.
And the world's best one is probably a pushrod car is 750, and then the Carrera engine cars are $1 million to $3 million, depending on which derivative they are. I've always said if I had to have one car, it would be a Speedster, an old car.
It's interesting because when you were going through your list, I was actually thinking about the VW Beetle.
Yeah,
which is not too far off from the Speedster. And I was thinking if Steve doesn't say Beetle, I should bring it up because that's another one that I think you can just kind of tweak and it'll run forever.
If you have a baseline of a good Beetle, it's a million-mile car. I mean, if you keep the rust off of it, everything's fine. And if you went new cars, Matt, G-Wagon, Bentley GT, which I've done is change the oil on. I mean, most new cars.
Sure. I mean, a lot of new cars are going to be like that.
They're going to be, but you can't. You open up the engine bay and you look and you go, there's an engine in there somewhere.
I can't do anything about it, right? My new 911 was like, or 2014.
Yep.
I never had any problem with it in 10 years. It just
People that have problems with new cars. I mean, they do make bad new cars. But when you were talking about, you know, Kia as a brand, I've plenty of my friends, I've said, I need this. I need it. What should I buy? Go buy a Kia. It'll last you till you have grandchildren, yeah. And they're beautifully put together, and they're relatively inexpensive. So anything from Kia forward, it's tough to buy a lemon these days. And if somebody's manufacturing
right, but
a lemon,
the problem there is Soul. That
well,
that,
that's
about,
that's
right?
A different animal. Yeah. So I think a G-Wagon has plenty of Soul. I mean, I think that's
love
Hannah.
It
you,
so
you,
much.
You just did the G63 again. So
yes, I mean, it's an icon for a reason. I say it all the time, and I'm often made fun of my loyalty to it. But it's just one of those cars that it has. It's like the 911. It hasn't changed all that much since it was first produced.
Mm-hmm.
It was produced for a specific reason, for a specific purpose, with a specific point of view and philosophy. And I love it. You know, and. You know, it's unfair to judge a vehicle by the people who drive it. And I say that because I live in Hollywood and I go to work in Beverly Hills and there is a G-Wagon on every corner. And it's not fair to judge the poor car by who drives it.
Before we get too far past G-Wagon, we got an email from a listener.
Was it me?
No. The guy's name is Peter. I won't give his full name. His name is Peter.
Oh,
and he was writing with us about Bentleys. He said, I was in Desert Storm riding in a Humvee. I'm quoting him, his email. Riding in a Humvee. We used to have to pull over and wait for the coalition units driving them, the G-Wagons, to catch up. Which I thought was really interesting.
It's funny.
Well, a military Humvee versus a G-Wagon. I mean, we see the military Humvees... they'll have government sales, and you can buy one for next to nothing. And technically, they're not road legal. But if you come to Martha's Vineyard in the summertime, there's a half a dozen of them on the beach.
I have to drive one. And they
look like there's nothing to them, and they look like they could drive through a fortress.
Yeah.
Did you ever drive an H1?
No, I never drove one.
I had a couple of H1s in trade back in the day. And
so did the H1 have a different motor? They all had the big,
no.
6.2-liter V8 diesel, right?
Yeah, it's the same diesel
turbo
motor
diesel.
That's in the military car, I believe. And they were, it's the biggest thing with no space in it because of the transmission.
Yeah.
And we had one with the tire
the transmission
inflator
tunnel is like
deflator.
Five people lying down.
You could put four people in one of the H1 station wagons, and that's about it. I mean, you could throw some stuff in the back, but try parking one and driving one. When they came out, it was like, this is the most absurd thing. And then they've caught on.
Well, that's an awesome list, dude. I really think it's cool to get that kind of knowledge from somebody who has as much experience as you do. And I think it's cool that there was kind of – they weren't all, $3 million cars. There's something to choose for everybody, right? Because I would love to buy classic cars and get into the kind of fun that Hannah and Magnus are having, but I don't want the mechanics bills, you know?
What would you tell him, Steve? Someone who is fascinated by it but scared.
Well, I mean, I would, it's not because I have one, but it's partially because I have one, but I knew they were good cars, was E500. I mean, that is, to me, it's a benchmark car before Mercedes-Benz started decontenting their cars.
Right.
So every time I get in it, I marvel at the fact, now mind you, I was lucky enough to get one with very low mileage, but I just sold one last week on Bring a Trailer. It was actually a E500, it was a 94, and that market's gone a little soft, like a lot of markets have gone soft, and it was $36,000, it was 91,000 miles, and detailed with new tires, it looked like a 35,000-mile car, and it was black, which is rare, I mean, just flat black with a black interior, so you can get into that. I would probably, in your case, you really don't want to fix anything, $45,000, $50,000 max.
I'm on the same page, but I'm thinking more like a 560 SEL or...
Also,
ooh,
great cars.
Yeah.
Great cars.
I'm curious, Steven. I know we're a little bit running short on time, but can you just give us a look at... You know, you mentioned the market softening a little bit. Is there anything that's really holding its value or even going up?
Oh, sure. Quick 30 seconds on the market. You know, everything goes through a cycle. And I think looking at the last 15 years, the market peaked in 14. It peaked again in 22. Everything has kind of now corrected to pre-COVID pricing, as they say, because we had that bump in 2021 where everybody lost their mind.
Unnatural. Yeah. Yes.
And now everything's gone behind that. People always say, you know, geez, a lot of things are going down in price. And that's true. A lot of things from the 50s and 60s, guys are aging out of. What's going up is the newer stuff. And
the 80s and 90s stuff.
No, even the 2000s and later. Yeah. So there are people, and Hannah knows this firsthand, there are people that collect every derivative of Porsche made from 2010 onwards.
They've got a lot of work to do.
They got to pick a paint a sample color, and they want the lowest mileage, and they're going to collect them like Skittles and jelly beans, and they're going to have a full garage of things that look identical, except they're not.
Undriven.
Yeah, so those cars, that market is still really hot. But, there are people that, there's another collector from Massachusetts who is a very, well-paid executive in Massachusetts for a handful of years. And he collected a wide variety of cars, had great taste in cars, painted them all the same shade of red. I don't know why people collect things and do the, I just look at it and go, whatever makes you happy, that's fine. You collect what you want, collect what makes you happy. There's this, again, a thing I've said in the past where if you walk into your garage and you look at your car and it lowers your blood pressure, you've succeeded. And if you get in it and it raises your blood pressure, you've just gone two for two.
Nice.
That's what it's all about for me anyway.
Yeah.
Hannah, to the market, there's always things that go up and there's always things that go down. As long as people are still trading, I think the bubble has burst a little bit, and now we're in a flat period and we're waiting for the next ramp up should it come. There's no guarantee that it will, but it has three times over the last 7 or 8 year periods where things all of a sudden go up. And if I knew what was going to go, because people say, well, what would you put your money in? And I would say, not cars, because it's unpredictable.
Right.
And when something falls off, it goes off overnight. If you can buy something and enjoy it and sell it for what you have into it, you've just beat the odds.
But don't you think as we make this transition to EVs, which if you're a fan or not, you got to recognize that the car makers have put so many billions of dollars into this and governments have mandated so much that there's no turning back, at least not in the next few decades, right? As we make this shift away from ICE cars, how does that affect the market? Like all of a sudden now, you're not going to be able to get a big V8. You're not going to be, car makers aren't making V12s anymore.
Right. It'd be like owning a horse. Yeah, horses were made redundant when Henry Ford came along, right? I mean, you didn't have to clean up poop on the street anymore, and the horses were put to pasture. Doesn't mean people stop riding horses. So I think the cars, an internal combustion engine car will be coveted by a select group of people, and it'll be rare. It'll be like going to a horse show. I mean, I don't think that'll happen in my generation. I think we're talking 50 years out when it becomes that rare, but I think kids are into ICE cars more than we give them credit for. And I think there's 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, boys and girls, all the way through, college kids who still look at cars and go, I want to do that. That's fun to me, and whether they have, a 200,000 mile Subaru that they're fixing, or whether, they've got something that dad has let them drive, there's still that passion in younger people, which 10 years ago, I would have said it's dying off. I think it skipped a generation. And a friend of mine said, my sons had no interest in collecting cars. Their kids do. So it's somehow hiccuped, I think, a little bit, but there's still people there.
Yep.
So,
well, it's been great having you in the studio.
Thank you so much, Steve, for
the invitation, you guys. I mean, this has been a blast.
We'll have to do it again.
Yeah.
Steve could be a regular. He could be a repeat guest.
Yeah, I know.
Sign me up for whenever you need me to come to New York.
And once we get him on some Monkey 47, then we'll get all the names of the people that he refuses to say now.
The shy people. The shy person.
Yeah, we'll really get him going.
All right, that's all we have time for today. Next week, we have my friend and the CEO of Ducati, Claudio Domenicali, coming in.
I can't wait. Email us at hotpursuit@bloomberg.net. We love all of your emails and we do respond to them. Give us a day or two, but we promise we will respond. Thank you for all of your comments and feedback.
I'm Matt Miller.
And I'm Hannah Elliott. And this is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.